The Federal News Update for Thursday, November 20th, 2025. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
And for our deep dive today, we are doing something pretty ambitious. We are aiming for a truly exhaustive, granular review of everything the U.S. federal government has done over the last 24 to 36 hours.
And we mean everything. We're not just looking at the big headlines. We're digging into every reported action and activity since the beginning of November 19th. Across all three branches.
What the sources really show is this incredible period of, I guess you'd call it policy compression. It feels like a whole month's worth of activity was jammed into a single day.
It really was. And a clear theme emerges. The executive branch was, well, strategically pursuing unilateral power. We're seeing these really clever technical maneuvers to bypass the Senate, to enforce national policy, and to make these huge geopolitical shifts.
But at the same time, you have these rare moments where Congress actually comes together, like with the Epstein files. So what we want to do for you is provide the essential context, not just what happened, but what it all means for where federal policy is heading.
So let's start where the action was most concentrated. That has to be the executive branch and its tactical maneuvering around regulatory agencies. And there's no better example than what just happened at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The CFPB.
Right. An agency that is, already facing what you could call an existential threat. And the key action here was a nomination that came down on November 18th. Stuart Levenbach for CFPB director. But this wasn't really about hiring Stuart Levenbach, was it?
Not at all. It was, depending on your view, either procedural genius or extreme procedural cynicism. The acting director, Russell Vaught, was about to hit his time limit. His 210-day limit was coming up in early December.
So he was about to be timed out by statute.
He was. So this nomination of Levenbach, which a spokesperson called just a technical step, is really designed to trigger a feature in the Federal Vacancies Reform Act, the FVRA.
And the FVRA is what allows them to, well, to essentially buy more time. It extends the clock.
It extends the clock, exactly. By putting a formal nominee forward, even if that nominee is never going to get a hearing, it resets the clock for the acting director for another 210 days.
So by doing this, they've effectively kicked the can down the road until June of 2026.
All the way to June 2026. And that means Russell Vaught, who has been very public about his desire to roll back the agency's powers and, you know, eventually shut it down entirely, gets to stay in charge. No Senate confirmation needed. He has a free hand to continue his deregulatory agenda.
And that agenda is moving at an incredible speed. We have to look at what's being pushed through right now. For example, the proposed changes to Regulation B.
Yes, Regulation B. This implements a key part of the Dodd-Frank Act, the part that requires the collection of data on small business lending.
And the changes here are, they seem small, but they're incredibly significant.
Oh, they're huge. The density of the rulemaking here translates directly into massive regulatory relief for lenders. The CFPB is proposing to narrow the reporting requirements to just what they call core, widely used lending products.
So what does that exclude?
Well, it conveniently excludes some very lucrative and, frankly, sometimes predatory areas. Things like merchant cash advances, farm credit system loans, and small dollar loans are just gone. No data collected on them anymore.
And beyond just excluding types of loans, they're changing who even has to report the data in the first place.
It has thresholds.
The thresholds. Mm-hmm. This is the really big one. Before, if you were a financial institution and you made 100 of these covered loans a year, you had to report.
100. Okay. Seems reasonable.
Now they're proposing to raise that threshold to 1,000.
1,000. That's a tenfold increase.
A tenfold increase over 2 years.
Mm.
And they're also raising the definition of a small business from 1 million in gross annual revenue to 5 million. So what does that do when you combine all of that?
It means the universe of data being collected about small business lending in America just shrinks dramatically. It will be incredibly difficult for anyone, policymakers, watchdogs, journalists, to track lending patterns or, you know, potential discrimination.
And it wasn't just small business data. The agency also went directly after state-level consumer protections.
Yes. They issued what's called an interpretive rule on the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the FCRA. This is the main federal law that governs your credit report.
Okay.
And this new rule basically says that the federal FCRA preempts or overrides most state laws related to credit reporting.
And that has an immediate impact, right, in certain states.
An immediate and a pretty severe impact. There are about 15 states, including places like California and Colorado, that have passed laws to restrict or outright ban medical debt from appearing on consumer credit reports. This federal action just wiped those state-level protections out.
And at the same time, they're also moving to reduce transparency around companies that have broken the law in the past.
That's right. They rescinded the 2024 non-bank registry rule. This was a rule that required non-bank financial companies, think payday lenders, mortgage servicers, to register publicly if they'd been hit with an enforcement order.
So a public database of bad actors, essentially.
A public database of bad actors. And the CFPB's justification was that it was too much of a regulatory burden and, you know, wasn't necessary. So less data, less transparency, and more federal power over the states. That's the trifecta.
And all of this is happening under the shadow of this ticking clock, a funding crisis that, frankly, the administration itself seems to have engineered.
It absolutely is a self-imposed crisis. The clock is set to run out on December 31st, 2025. Acting Director Vaught has put out this legal opinion arguing that the Bureau has to spend down its current funds and can't draw any more money from the Federal Reserve.
Which is how it's always been funded.
For its entire existence. It's an independent funding stream designed to protect it from political pressure. But Vaught's argument is that because the Fed currently lacks combined earnings, drawing funds would be unlawful. It's a novel legal theory that, if it holds, means the agency literally runs out of money in a few weeks.
And you can see the urgency that this deadline creates in the policymaking itself.
Oh, absolutely. The time compression is a dead giveaway. The proposals we just talked about related to the Equal Credit Opportunity Act are being pushed through with the shortest possible public comment period allowed by law, just 30 days.
They're trying to finalize the rules before the lights go out.
That's the goal. Finalize the rules before the money runs out, or, just as importantly, before Congress is forced to step in and put the CFPB on the normal appropriations cycle, which would destroy its independence for good.
It's an incredible tactical play. You use a technical personnel maneuver to keep your guy in charge. And then you use a self-made funding crisis to force a permanent structural change to the agency itself.
It is strategic chaos, all designed for maximum long-term effect.
So let's pivot from financial regulation to tech, because the executive branch is using a very similar playbook, unilateral power threats over funding. But this time, the target is state laws on artificial intelligence.
Yes. Reports surfaced on November 19th about a leaked draft of a new executive order. The title alone tells you everything you need to know. Eliminating state law obstruction of national AI policy.
And this is so remarkable because it comes right on the heels of a massive legislative defeat for the administration on this exact issue.
A huge defeat. The Senate recently voted 99-1 against a provision that would have created a federal moratorium on state AI laws. 99-1, you don't see that every day.
No. So instead of, you know, accepting that legislative consensus, the administration is just turning to the executive pen to get what it wants.
Exactly. And the strategy outlined in this draft EO is incredibly aggressive. It has three main prongs.
What's the first one?
First, it sets up an AI litigation task force inside the Department of Justice. Its only job will be to sue states over their AI laws. And the draft even calls out California and Colorado by name, arguing their laws are a burden on interstate commerce.
Okay, so a legal assault. What's this second and arguably more powerful prong?
This is where it gets really serious. This is what experts call coercive federalism. The EO threatens to restrict a state's access to critical federal infrastructure money if they don't fall in line.
So they're tying policy compliance to funding.
Specifically to the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program, the BEAD program. This is the money states are counting on to build out high-speed internet in rural and underserved communities. The EO says if your state has AI laws the administration thinks are onerous, you could lose that funding.
That is an impossible choice for a state governor. Protect your citizens with local AI rules on, say, child safety, or get the funding you need to close the digital divide.
It's an incredibly powerful lever. And the third prong just brings in the existing federal regulator.
The FTC and the FCC.
Right. The EO directs them to start their own efforts to preempt state laws using whatever authority they already have. The stated goal is to avoid a patchwork of 50 state regulatory regimes that they claim hurts U.S. competitiveness in the global AI race.
But I have to ask, when the Senate votes 99-1 against something and the executive branch turns around and uses financial threats to achieve the same goal, isn't that a fundamental challenge to the whole idea of checks and balances?
That is the central constitutional question here. Critics are arguing this is just designed to clear the field for big tech to neutralize all these local efforts around privacy, algorithmic bias, and labor automation. It's a huge gamble that is almost certain to trigger immediate lawsuits from states arguing it's a massive federal overreach.
From this kind of aggressive regulatory preemption, let's turn to outright institutional dismantling, the soft launch of breaking up the Department of Education.
Right. This was reported on November 18th. It's the beginning of the execution phase of the administration's long-stated plan to shut the department down entirely.
And how are they starting?
Secretary Linda McMahon announced six new interagency agreements. These are formal plans to start moving programs and the people who run them over to other federal agencies.
This is the proof of concept phase, right? To show Congress that the department's functions can just be absorbed elsewhere.
That's the idea. And we're talking about billions of dollars in grant programs. The Department of Labor, for instance, is now set to oversee a huge chunk of federal funding for K-12 schools, including Title I grants for low-income communities.
So money that used to come from the Department of Education will now come from the Department of Labor.
Exactly. And other pieces are being moved around, too. The Bureau of Indian Education is heading to the Interior Department. International education programs like the Fulbright scholarships are going over to the State Department.
And what does this mean for the thousands of people who actually work at the Education Department?
It means profound uncertainty. During the recent 43-day government shutdown, a lot of them received reduction in force notices, RIF notices.
Layoff warnings.
Basically, yes. Those were canceled when the government reopened, but Secretary McMahon acknowledged that those RIFs could easily come back after the current funding resolution expires on January 30th.
So they're just living with this threat hanging over their heads?
Absolutely. The strategy is clear. It's a slow burn dismantling. You start by moving functions around administratively, like the 13 employees who are now temporarily co-managed by the Labor Department, and you structurally weaken the agency. Then, once you've shown it can be done, you go to Congress for the final legislative push to close it for good.
It's structural change disguised as a simple administrative reorganization. And as critics point out, when you move K-12 school funding to the Department of Labor, you are signaling a pretty major shift in federal priorities.
You really are. You're shifting the focus from, you know, educational outcomes to workforce training and economic utility. It's a fundamental change in philosophy.
That shift in focus takes us neatly into national security and geopolitics, where the Treasury Department had an incredibly busy day. Sanctions, cybercrime, and a massive new strategic alliance.
Yes, the focus at Treasury was all about disrupting the supply chains of global criminal networks, both financial and technical. On November 19th, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, announced these coordinated sanctions with Australia and the UK.
This shows some pretty deep integration with our key allies.
It really does. And the target was Russian cybercrime infrastructure. But this was a tactical pivot. They weren't just going after individual hackers. They went after the platforms that enable them.
The hosting services.
Specifically, a St. Petersburg firm called MediaLand that provides something called bulletproof hosting. This is a service that ransomware gangs like Lockbit and Blacksuit absolutely depend on to launch their attacks against, you know, U.S. hospitals, schools, and critical infrastructure.
So you take out the platform, you make it harder and more expensive for the criminals to operate.
That's the goal. And they also went after the companies that helped these groups evade sanctions. They hit a UK-based front company called Hypercore, which was being used by a previously sanctioned group to move money. It's a very sophisticated approach targeting the entire ecosystem.
Now let's turn to the other major OFAC action. This one is less about keyboards and servers and more about, well, just sheer brutality. The case of former Canadian Olympian Ryan James Wedding.
This story is, it's honestly shocking. It reads like the script for a movie. Wedding is on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. He's accused of running this massive operation, trafficking multi-ton quantities of cocaine from South America into the U.S. and Canada.
But it goes way beyond just drug trafficking.
It does. He's also accused of ordering dozens of murders around the globe, including the murder of a federal witness back in January of this year. He allegedly uses cryptocurrency to launder the money. It's a highly sophisticated and incredibly violent organization.
And the Treasury action didn't just target him. It went after his entire support network.
His entire logistical and professional support structure. They sanctioned 9 individuals and 9 companies. That includes his wife, who allegedly helped launder money and commit violence, and a former Mexican law enforcement officer who was providing protection.
And most disturbingly, a lawyer.
Yes, a Canadian attorney named Deepak Balwant Paredkar. The allegations against him are just stunning. OFAC says he didn't just provide illegal services and facilitate bribery and murder. He allegedly allowed Wedding Screw to listen in on the privileged legal communications of his other clients.
So he was betraying his other clients to help this criminal enterprise.
It is a complete violation of every professional and ethical standard imaginable. And it just shows how these financial sanctions are now used to disrupt that professional class, the lawyers, the accountants that enable these massive criminal groups.
And the State Department is clearly taking this very seriously.
Very. They just increased the reward for Wedding's capture from $10 million up to $15 million. And the action also led to the seizure of some incredible assets, including a $13 million Mercedes CLK GTR.
From disrupting criminal networks, let's shift to building strategic ones. The day's biggest geopolitical news was the formal designation of Saudi Arabia as a major non-NATO ally, an MNNA.
This is a huge deal. It's a massive strategic realignment in the Middle East, and it was announced at a U.S.-Saudi investment summit. It signals a very deep level of trust and partnership.
And it coincided with some massive economic and defense agreements.
It did. $270 billion in deals were announced. That includes sales of American-made tanks and critically advanced F-35 fighter jets. And in return, the Saudis have committed to investing $1 trillion in the U.S.
But the real long-term strategic play here seems to be about two things: technology and minerals.
That is the absolute core of it. The U.S. has approved the sale of our most advanced AI chips, the Blackwell GPUs, to Saudi Arabia. The goal is to anchor the entire Saudi AI ecosystem to American technology, not Chinese technology.
And the second piece is about securing supply chains.
Critical mineral supply chains. Right now, China controls somewhere between 90 and 99% of the global refinement and processing for key elements that you need for everything from defense manufacturing to AI chips.
So the idea is to build up Saudi Arabia as a partner in that supply chain, as an alternative to China.
Exactly. It is a major geopolitical move designed to secure America's economic and technological independence from Beijing for decades to come.
But it's not without risks. There are some pretty significant security concerns here.
There are, and experts are warning about this. You know, China has played a huge role in building out Saudi Arabia's network infrastructure. They have advanced cyber capabilities. So you're taking a calculated risk by sharing this incredibly sensitive AI technology with a partner whose digital backyard has been, you know, heavily influenced by your main global competitor.
Speaking of immediate security risks, we got a really sobering update from the Department of Defense.
Mm-hmm.
It highlights a vulnerability that has nothing to do with AI or geopolitics, but just our basic digital lives.
Yes. A new report from the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, found that the DoD is failing to address the threats from what they call publicly available data, or PAD.
So this is information that's just out there for sale.
For sale legally by data brokers. They're collecting and selling personal and operational information about DoD personnel and their families.
And when you combine that data with, say, social media posts or things for sale on the dark web, like military training manuals,
it becomes a complete vulnerability profile.
Exactly.
You can expose sensitive training exercises, equipment modifications, even strategic partnerships. The real failure here isn't stopping people from creating data that's impossible. The failure is not mitigating the risk from the aggregation and sale of that data. The DoD is way behind the curve on a threat that is happening right now.
And before we move on to Congress, just one quick operational update related to the shutdown.
Yes, a bit of good news. DoD civilian employees were scheduled to receive all of their back pay on the Sunday following this reporting period, finally closing the books on that period of financial stress for them.
Okay, that sets the table for the legislative branch. And here we saw this fascinating contrast. Congress showed it can unify and force accountability, but it also aggressively asserted its power over local government. Let's start with the win for accountability, the Epstein Files Transparency Act.
This was a really powerful moment. It's a textbook case of how Congress can overcome executive branch resistance when there is overwhelming bipartisan will. The Senate passed the bill unanimously on November 19th, sending it to the president's desk.
And that was after the House passed it with a massive 427-1 vote.
Just a huge, huge margin. But what's really important is how it got to the floor in the House. It didn't happen because leadership wanted it to. It happened because of a discharge petition.
A procedural tool that forces a vote.
It forces a vote. A bipartisan group of members got enough signatures to compel leadership to act. Faced with that kind of political momentum, the president, who had previously opposed the bill's release, did a complete 180 and said he had nothing to hide.
And the bill itself is pretty straightforward.
Very. It gives the Justice Department 30 days to release all the relevant files on Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, with very narrow exceptions for things like protecting victims' privacy and classified information. It's a big win for transparency.
So from that moment of unity, let's turn to conflict. The House spent a lot of time on November 19th intervening directly in the local affairs of Washington, D.C.
Yes, an aggressive assertion of congressional authority over the district's home rule. The House passed two bills. The first one was called the Clean D.C. Act. It passed 233 to 190.
And what did that bill do?
It completely repealed a local D.C. law from 2022. That law had put new restrictions on police tactics, like neck restraints, and had increased public access to body camera footage.
And the debate was pretty heated.
Very. Supporters, like the D.C. Police Union, said the local law was anti-police and had led to a historic exodus of officers. But opponents, like D.C.'s delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton, called it an affront to home rule and said Congress was just using D.C. as a test case for a national political agenda.
And the second bill, the D.C. Crimes Act, also overrides local policy.
It does. It basically gets rid of D.C.'s no cash bail policy for certain offenses and makes it easier to charge juveniles as adults for serious crimes. And House Speaker Johnson was very explicit about the national implications. He framed this as a potential model for other Democrat-run cities.
So using their unique power over D.C. to pilot a national policy agenda.
That's clearly the strategy.
Now let's look at a bipartisan bill that was a direct result of the government shutdown we keep mentioning. The effort to make sure air traffic controllers get paid.
Right. This legislation was introduced by top Republicans and Democrats on the House Transportation Committee. It's a direct response to the absolute chaos we saw in the aviation system during the 43-day shutdown. And it's even more urgent because we have this critical shortage of air traffic controllers right now. The system is just brittle.
And the really clever part of this bill is how they propose to pay for it.
It's a very elegant solution. Instead of using the big aviation trust funds, which gets expensive and complicated, they want to tap a little used insurance fund.
The one set up after 9/11.
That's the one. It's a $2.6 billion fund that was created to reimburse airlines if the government ever had to, you know, commandeer their planes for a national emergency. It's barely been touched and has just grown with interest. The idea is to use that money to keep the FAA running for 4 to 6 weeks during a shutdown. It's designed to take the air traffic control system out of the political hostage-taking of a funding fight.
We also saw Congress use a powerful tool, the Congressional Review Act, to overturn a rule on land use in Alaska.
Yes. The House passed SJ Res 80, which uses the CRA to nullify a Biden administration rule from 2022. That rule had withdrawn millions of acres in Alaska's National Petroleum Reserve from potential oil and gas development.
So this overturns that conservation measure.
It does. And supporters, including local Inupiat communities, argued this was essential for their economic livelihood. They said they need responsible development to fund their schools, their clinics, their utilities. Opponents, of course, argued it was a necessary conservation plan. But by using the CRA, Congress is trying to lock in this policy reversal permanently.
And finally, a really strange and fascinating internal fight. The House was debating whether to repeal a special provision that the Senate had given itself.
This is a wild one. A provision was slipped into an appropriations bill that allows senators to sue the Justice Department for $500,000 per account. Per occurrence, if their phone records were searched in an investigation.
That sounds incredibly specific.
It is. It stems directly from the Arctic Frost investigation when the former special counsel Jack Smith subpoenaed the records of some senators. So the Senate basically gave itself a legal weapon to retaliate against the executive branch for investigating it.
And the potential liability for the DOJ is enormous.
Potentially tens of millions of dollars. One congressman said on the floor that he knows of at least one senator who plans to sue for that much. So the House is trying to repeal it, and it caused this huge split within the Senate Republican Conference. It's a raw fight over separation of powers and institutional self-protection.
This clash over institutional turf brings us to the federal workforce itself, where the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, is trying to modernize hiring while also facing a huge lawsuit over job protections.
That's right. OPM is pushing hard to revamp its main hiring platform, USA Hire. This is the assessment tool that agencies use to vet candidates, and they're expecting a huge surge in its use because of the president's new merit hiring plan.
And they are looking to bring AI into the federal hiring process in a big way.
In a huge way. They put out a formal request for information asking tech companies for ideas on how to use AI and machine learning to develop and score tests. They're also worried about applicants using AI chatbots to cheat, and they're looking at things like secure, asynchronous video interviews. It's a massive push to modernize.
But at the very same time, you have this massive legal fight brewing over the revival of Schedule F.
The ghost of Schedule F, yes. The National Treasury Employees Union, the NTEU, filed a lawsuit last week against OPM. They're accusing the agency of violating the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, by not releasing documents about this new Schedule Policy Career Order.
And this is the order that would reclassify tens of thousands of career federal employees.
An estimated 50,000 of them, making them at-will employees, basically making it much easier to fire them for political reasons.
And what's the administration's justification for this?
They say it will increase accountability and allow them to quickly remove employees who are, and this is a quote, intentionally subverting presidential directives. The union, of course, says this is just a direct assault on the merit-based civil service.
Now let's look at another operational challenge. NASA is dealing with a pretty intense controversy over consolidating its Goddard Space Flight Center.
Yes. NASA is moving very quickly to shrink the Goddard campus in Maryland by about 25%. They want to empty out 13 buildings by March of 2026.
And the union is warning that this is happening too fast.
Way too fast. The union says this hasty pace, which even involved making people move equipment during the government shutdown, risks the destruction of unique and critical labs. They're worried it could set back major missions, like the Roman Space Telescope.
But NASA says this is about financial necessity.
Right. They say with rising costs and a flat budget, this consolidation will save them $10 million a year and help them avoid $64 million in deferred maintenance. It's that classic conflict. Immediate cost savings versus the potential for long-term damage to scientific capability.
Finally, let's just touch on the sheer volume of regulatory action that was happening in the background, plus some key judicial context.
The administrative engine was definitely running at full steam. The single biggest document filed on November 19th was the 157-page proposed rule from the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers redefining the waters of the United States.
Which is a huge deal for environmental and land use policy.
A massive deal. And you also had FEMA filing notices on flood hazards, the president designating National Adoption Month. Just the normal, voluminous business of government was also proceeding.
And in the courts, while there were no major rulings, the cases that are still pending really hang over everything we've discussed.
They really do. The Supreme Court is still weighing cases that could completely reshape presidential power. You have Trump v. Slaughter, which challenges the very constitutionality of independent agencies. And then you have Learning Resources, Inc. v. Trump.
And that's the one that challenges the president's tariff authority.
His authority to impose tariffs under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA, if the court rules against the administration in that case, it would be a huge blow to the executive branch's ability to conduct trade policy unilaterally. It would force them to go back to Congress.
So stepping back from all this incredible detail, What's the single theme that ties this all together? What really defined the last day and a half in the federal government?
I think it's not just about a power grab. It's about speed and procedural mastery. The executive branch is maximizing its agenda by using these technical, non-legislative tools. We saw it with the FVRA at the CFPB. We saw it with the funding threats and the AI order to get around a 99-1 Senate vote. The strategy is to force rapid structural change by weaponizing loopholes and funding threats.
And Congress, meanwhile, seems only able to act decisively when there's this huge public outcry, like with the Epstein files. But on these complex regulatory issues, it seems to be ceding authority either to the executive or to the courts.
And if you look at all the disparate things we talked about, paying air traffic controllers, dismantling the education department, the fight over AI, they all come back to the same fundamental leverage point, exploiting structural instability and regulatory chaos to push a centralized agenda.
That's a great synthesis. So here's a final thought for you to consider as we close. We talked about that new GAO report, the one that said The Department of Defense is failing to mitigate the threats from publicly available data. All this personal information being legally bought and sold by data brokers.
Right, the data that's out there today exposing real vulnerabilities.
So given the intense focus we just discussed from both the White House and Congress on regulating future AI models, on the fear of what AI might do someday, do you think the U.S. government risks being strategically distracted? Are we so focused on preventing a theoretical future problem that we're completely ignoring the massive, unaddressed, and actively exploited security risk of the data that's already out there right now?
That is the essential question of strategic priority, isn't it? The fear of a hypothetical future AI threat could be blinding us to the clear and present danger of our current data reality. And that blind spot could be the most dangerous vulnerability of all.
Until the next deep dive, stay informed.
And keep asking the challenging questions.